This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Rick Snyder says he's pleased with an official opinion from State Attorney General Bill Schuette. The legal opinion says the state constitution does not allow the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund to pay for dredging and other types of maintenance on public harbors.
As we look at, let's look out to the future, but I wouldn't expect to use the trust fund at all. That's not a place I would look at for resources for this.
The governor and the attorney general say the Natural Resources Trust Fund can only be used to acquire and improve property for the public's use. The governor and the legislature reached a compromise earlier on an emergency dredging bill, and that one taps into the Waterways Trust Fund and the state's general fund. That's for dredging this spring to clear harbors suffering from record low water levels. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now. So, Rick, help us understand the real implications of this opinion.
Well, like you just pointed out, that the governor and the legislature, some legislative Republicans who wanted to tap into the Natural Resources Trust Fund to pay for this emergency harbor dredging, that they found another way to go about it. But there's still this question of what might happen if the Federal Army Corps of Engineers backlog in dredging projects persists, for example, you know, what we might do going into the future. There's some legislation that's been introduced that would rewrite the rules for the trust fund to allow it to be used for maintenance, and so then it could be used for dredging. And what this says is that when the Natural Resources Trust Fund was created, and it comes from, the money comes from things like oil and gas leases on state land, that it's only to be used to acquire property, land, or water, or to do capital projects, you know, big one-time improvements, and not for maintenance. And what this says is that dredging is basically maintenance, so it won't be used for that. And it's important to know that this is a formal attorney general opinion, and these are binding on state government. They have the force of law unless, in this instance, a judge overturns that interpretation.
So kind of tie this up for us then, Rick. Exactly where does this leave money for dredging the lakes?
Well, one of the things that the opinion says is that there are a lot of other places, that there are other trust funds, for example, that the state could look to take care of dredging projects. And of course, there's always, if you decide it's important enough, that the legislature and the governor could go to sort of what is the state's main checkbook, the general fund, and appropriate money for the purpose. Obviously, the best case scenario would be that the Great Lakes water levels are restored to what they normally are, what they typically are, and that the Army Corps of Engineers also picks up the pace in dredging projects, and that maybe this won't be necessary to keep things ready for shipping and recreational boating in coming years.
Well, Rick, there's been a lot of talk about this emergency dredging because, as you said, the lake levels are just so low. But let's look down the road somewhat. What happens if this problem continues, and where would the money come from if dredging continues to be needed down the road?
Well, what the governor says is that is an unknown, but they would have to find something. It's just that in this case, you know, a lot of environmental groups, a lot of conservation groups were afraid that there's sort of this general movement in the legislature to put the brakes on property acquisition, and that one of the ways that they could do it and simultaneously deal with the harbor dredging emergency is go to the Natural Resources Trust Fund. And what this opinion says is that's not going to happen.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Rick.
My pleasure, Cindy.
You won't get much disagreement with the statement that one of the crown jewels of Michigan is indeed the collection known as the Great Lakes. And the future of the Great Lakes, their management, the usage, all of that was the focus of a forum that was held recently at MSU's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, zeroing in on the key questions. How should we manage these huge bodies of fresh water and do it in a way that guarantees they're available for future generations? Joining me is the Deputy Director of the University of Michigan Water Center, Jennifer Reed, and the Director of the Michigan Office of the Great Lakes, John Allen. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Want to have you give us a sense of what you see as the biggest threats that face the Great Lakes. I'll start with you, John.
Well, one of the threats facing the Great Lakes, obviously, is invasive species. Invasive species have been here. They've been here a long time. They've come in from a variety of different ways, roughly over 180 species are now here. So managing the ones that we have here, making sure that we understand them and fighting them back where we can, but also making sure that we're closing all the doors to the invasion of new species. The big one that's on everybody's mind is Asian carp, and making sure that that doesn't show up. So it's a twofold problem. One, first, we have to manage the ones that are here and the changes that they have brought to the Great Lakes. The other one is to make sure that we close the door on not having additional ones, including the carp, get into the Great Lakes.
I think the carp certainly is something that when you talk just to people who care at all about the Great Lakes, the idea that there's some little electric fence on a canal in Illinois possibly being the gateway to keeping them in or out doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. I don't know. Are we right or wrong in that sense, Jen?
Well, you know, I'm no expert on the Asian carp, yes. I'll just say. But I do know that that's not necessarily the only way they can get into the region either. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing we want to be thinking about when we're thinking about these invasive threats are all the various vectors and ways they can get in. You know, if they're coming in through shipping or organisms in trade or coming in through recreational boating activities, we just need to be aware of all the potentials and putting as much energy and effort into closing all the doors as we are have currently focused on Chicago. I mean, that's really heightening our awareness, and that's really important. But we can't just focus on that particular vector. We need to be thinking about other vectors as well.
I agree. I think the region has pulled together in understanding the threat that Asian carp present. And between the work that the Army Corps of Engineers is doing, the work that the states are doing, the work at the provincial and regional levels are all very important, specifically as we talked about on the carp and their presence within the waterway systems coming up through the Mississippi River and into the Great Lakes. That is an avenue of threat that we have to be very diligent about and look at as many options as we possibly can. The work that the Great Lakes Commission, for instance, has done in highlighting management potential and ways to continue to make sure that we close that door. However, as Jen said, we do have to worry about the other pathways and other species that could come into the Great Lakes. And it's not enough just to attend to the one. It's good that the one is on everybody's mind, mm-hmm. but we have to realize that there are others and other threats. Current work recently between the United States Coast Guard and the United States EPA and the work of the states and the regions in harmonizing, working to harmonize their standards around ballast water, for instance, is another major piece that continues to work through the system, but one that we're very attentive to. Ballast water has historically been a big source of invasion or source of invasive species into the Great Lakes Basin. And we're pleased to see that the Coast Guard and the EPA has taken some good steps nationally to harmonize what would be a national set of standards around ballast water management.
So we're looking at a need for state policy, but also certainly national policy.
Well, let me put that in three bins.
Yeah.
The states have to do what the states need to do within their interest. Now, we have to make sure that we're doing that in harmony with the other states. Mm-hmm. So there is a relationship there on a state basis, state-to-state basis. But I'll add to that is also the regionality. These states are managed by eight states, by two provinces, by two national governments, and our what we do with Minnesota and Illinois is equally important to how we look at this resource with Quebec and with Ontario. And with both federal governments, we need to see, with all of our federal partners, we need to see this as a large collective system. A
lot of movable pieces
that
here.
We have obligations.
Yeah.
Yes.
There are. It is complicated. You asked about sort of the biggest threats.
Yes.
And I think there's another threat that we need to be thinking about that we have less control of from, say, a state or provincial or regional level, but we need to respond to, and that's mm-hmm. climate change. And to me, that then puts into sort of context or a set of threats, and that's just how we as human beings are thinking about the Great Lakes and reacting to the Great Lakes and thinking not so much about managing particular issues on an issue-by-issue basis, but really thinking about how we ourselves as human beings interact with the lakes and what we do along the shore, discharge into the lakes, discharge into the air, sort of thinking about how we manage our actions in relation to the lakes and the larger environment, as opposed to vice versa, thinking about how we manage the lakes themselves.
Mm. Yes. So where do you think we're at with that awareness and that self-awareness, maybe we should say?
I think we're starting to understand how important that is. If you look back in time over 100 years, we've seen the lakes vary a lot. And then we get to the point where the lakes are low or low below average, and then we're all surprised. They've been here before. They will be here again. They will be up again. We shouldn't be surprised when they're high again. What we have to make sure is we're building the interface of where humans are at that water's edge, which is so critically important in our ports and our coastal communities, building those interfaces to make sure that we understand how to build them in an environment that changes. The lakes aren't a fixed thing, and we build human systems around a fixed thing. We have to understand that these are dynamic, rising and lowering. One wonderful thing I think about in the Great Lakes, especially in our shallow parts in Saginaw Bay and in Western Lake Erie, as water level rises and lowers, it doesn't really just rise and lower, but it comes in and out. So for every, say, foot of rise or lower, it might expose 100 feet of beach. So think about these not as just up and down dynamics, but back and forth dynamics in the Great Lakes and how profound that is.
And that that affects so many things beyond enjoying the recreational side, but the economic side. If you rely on fishing to make a living, that's bad news.
That has historically been a very natural, very healthy function of the Great Lakes for water levels to rise and lower, reestablish wetlands. What Jen's talking about is understanding from now and looking forward, what are those dynamics? What's changed about that? Mm-hmm. What else do we need to attend to? And how do we help people understand how to build infrastructure and build our lives at the water's edge that reflect the changes that we're going to be seeing?
And build expectations around that as well, so that someone who purchases a home at certain level, maybe high lake levels or low, and when those system change, as it will, go up or down, they're not surprised, that they have anticipated that that's going to happen. They recognize it's natural and that it's something that they can live with.
If you're just joining me, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, talking about essentially the future of the Great Lakes based on the fact that there was a recent forum held at MSU's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research exploring the Great Lakes. And I'm talking with the director of the Michigan Office of the Great Lakes, John Allen, here in the studio, and also the deputy director of the University of Michigan Water Center, Jennifer Reed. You're really covering many things such as pollution and development and cargo ship channels, so many things under the umbrellas of concerns. Apart from relying on public policy, what's your challenge to concerned citizens, to the people of Michigan listening to us talking, who care about the Great Lakes? What's our personal responsibility or course of action?
Boy, that's a big question.
It is.
because I think in order to answer that question, we need to know how educated the public is to really understand the system. Hmm. So I think it's easy just to say, don't do bad things. Your lawn fertilizer. There's a whole list of actions that, are out there and people should be thinking about. But I really think that it behooves us who have the information to make it more available in ways that citizens can understand and provide them with actions that are going to have an impact. Mm-hmm. So it sounded like I just tossed off those other individual actions. Not really, but you need to understand why you're being asked to do those things and what the impact of your own changes you might make in your life have cumulatively. So we're talking about hundreds, thousands, millions of people making changes. The cumulative impact of those small changes is significant and does then end up in something that will be a better future for the region.
I'd like to frame it a little bit differently. So one of the ways that we think about this is how do you move our belief, personal beliefs, in what has been historically such a water-rich region, in a place where we haven't had to think a lot about water or manage water in a way that really highlights its value.
Right.
I mean, given the fact that we have 20% of the world's fresh water here, tends to say it's probably a little less of value than where you only have a few drops or a couple of gallons a day. So part of it is really understanding how do we change our belief in water as a ubiquitous, plentiful resource and start to think about it and start to think about it in ways that say this probably has a little more value than we historically thought. How do I really think about it now as being a little more scarce or a little more valuable How do I start to think about conservation in a very water-rich area? And this has been very difficult, I think, for a lot of people to understand. But you talked earlier about a lot of places in this country, and I'd say the world, have looked at the Great Lakes fairly longingly.
Yes.
And one of the things that we hear to a person throughout Michigan is, let's make sure our water stays here.
It's a mindset change.
It's a fundamental mindset change throughout the whole region.
It is, and it's going to take a lot of public education and a lot of understanding what motivates people to help them then make those changes.
And I guess from where you sit, as director of the Office of the Great Lakes, John Allen, your challenge to our lawmakers, our governor, our policymakers.
Well, one of the things we have to continue to think about is what is the value proposition for the Great Lakes? What can they bring us that's unique to the region? What is our strategy around thinking about this as a valuable, phenomenal asset? What can we do unique that's here that can't be done somewhere else that may have a little less water? How important is waterborne transportation to the region? You mentioned that earlier. It's hugely important to our region. The world is more and more chasing calories, and by that I mean we're moving from 7 billion to 9 billion people over the next 20, 25 years or so. A statistic I heard fairly recently is within that 3 billion people worldwide will be entering the middle class. That is a staggering amount of expectation for food, agriculture. So what is the value proposition of that water in the Great Lakes in terms of servicing and supplying food to what is increasingly becoming a very hungry world? So I see great value looking forward in the Great Lakes. We need to understand how to utilize that, how to do that in a way that still works in harmony with healthy systems. The healthier the Great Lakes, the more economic value we can derive. These are deeply tie-barred together, and what we're doing is stitching back that relationship between a healthy economy and a healthy environment, but utilizing this phenomenal asset as we look ahead, and as we look ahead competitively with the world.
I've been talking with the director of the Michigan Office of Great Lakes, John Allen, and the deputy director of the University of Michigan Water Center, Jennifer Reed. Thank you both so much for being kind enough to join us in the studio today.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.